I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Protest in a new century is what we're talking about. The broadest incendiary storm cloud over this country since Nixon in Cambodia and the killings on campus at Kent State, Ohio. That was 40 years ago. So the story is old, it's new, it's fascinating, and it's unfinished. The climate march in New York last fall had much bigger one-day numbers, but the justice protest, if we can call it that, is everywhere, linked by more than just social media. Millennials, immigrants, black, white, and brown, high school kids, gay, straight, trans, and beyond, sharing access to a rainbow culture just below the surface. And then it popped out, and it keeps popping. Since the news last month from Ferguson, Missouri, and then Staten Island, New York, that white policemen don't get prosecuted for killing unarmed black men in America. The rest of the story is still to be learned from authorities that we hadn't heard of a month ago, like the young hip-hop oracle Tef Poe from St. Louis, who's played big stages from Stanford to Harvard in just the last few weeks, and in Washington, too.
It's real when you're standing in front of a tank or armored vehicle, MRAP, or a guy with body armor and an M16 in your face next to a person you never knew. I don't know y'all. Front line. I'm black, you black, he's white. We never met. But obviously at this moment, something in our core beliefs aligns. We may disagree on a bunch of other stuff, but we agree enough to be out here in the middle of the street in West Florissant to fight this.
Then there's the R&B singer D'Angelo, who rushed his new album, Black Messiah, into production to meet a ravenous demand for a protest soundtrack. In Boston this week, we caught three teenage girls on Tremont Street who had bolted school, happy to be engaged in a march of about 100 kids from Government Center past Boston Common.
Half of the students here, we just walked out of school.
To come protest.
The kids in my school, we pulled the fire alarm and some of us left.
We're gonna be suspended.
Some other students, they just walked out of class. I mean, if we can get the word out and have everyone do it, then it'd be better.
Things like this are happening every day all around the world, you know? It's not only just us. And it's beautiful because it's now the youth. It's the youth that are starting to do something about it. And it's really beautiful, yeah.
No justice, no peace, no racist police. No justice, no peace, no racist police.
We're hearing a variety of voices and angles this hour. A lead organizer from St. Louis, a hip-hop historian in the Bay Area, the Harvard minister, Jonathan Walton, two engaged intellectuals in our studio, Peniel Joseph from Tufts and Glenn Lowry from Brown. Our keynoter is Robin Kelly in Los Angeles, Nash Professor of American History at UCLA, chronicler of Black Freedom Dreams in one of his book titles. Our last open source conversation was about his celebrated biography of the one-off jazz immortal Thelonious Monk. I asked Robin Kelly on the phone to set today's protests in his longer context.
Protests around state violence and police, what they call misconduct, they take up much of the 20th century. If you look at almost every single urban rebellion from 1964 to about 1972, you're talking about 300 cities that blew up. In almost every case, those riots or rebellions were sparked by a case of police violence. It's not like it was 50% of the time or 70% of the time. We're talking about like 98% of the time. You're talking about 8 years, 250 people dead, 10,000 people injured, 500,000 people participating, billions of dollars in property damage, 60,000 people arrested in that 8-year period, tanks, machine guns, tear gas, all that was deployed. Now, when we talk about the militarization of the police, this is partly where it begins. Now, what's the difference between those moments and this moment? Well, in those moments, almost all of those uprisings were black and brown communities, mostly black communities. They were limited to ghettos. They were sort of isolated and very specific to those territories. What we're seeing now, and this is why I think it is unprecedented, are more multiracial, some cross-class. these nonviolent acts of civil disobedience occupying spaces that typically are not the contested ground of policing. And that's very, very different. And I think that we can attribute so much of this, this disruption, to what had become ground zero. That's Ferguson, Missouri, the suburb outside of St. Louis. And those young people and older people who stood up to the police and did so not as a result of a day or a week, but an ongoing confrontation that's going on to this very day, 3 months after the fact. Is it a new revolution? I'm just a historian. I never could predict the future. But I do know that it's not about to end anytime soon. And most importantly, the kinds of demands that are being made by these very kind of visionary, very militant young people are not your typical demands for simply a federal investigation or new law, but a real dismantling of the old police state. In talking to these young people, there are some things that are very different politically. One, they actually have a perspective on the international context of this. The fact that their internationalism has convinced some organizations to go to the United Nations to submit their findings in terms of police violence and the cost and consequences of police violence, that they see the United Nations as the higher form of law and order in a country that they're convinced has basically given up the rule of law. And the federal government has basically failed to protect us. And it's not as if people are not concerned about the everyday violence of poverty, the everyday violence of the circulation of guns, the everyday violence of an informal economy where people are trying to survive by any means, even if it means the suffering of people in their neighborhoods. That's a fact. But that is connected to a failure on the part of state, federal, and local governments to actually provide the basic needs and structure for legality. It's gone.
There's another interesting difference here. First of all, for a posture of resistance, just plain recognition of where we're at and pushing back, but also some sort of call for the hardest thing in the world, which is a kind of intellectual reassessment, even an emotional reassessment of a system which the protest is saying is built on white supremacy, always was.
It's not that this is the first time there's been a demand for, and let's just put it on the table, a revolutionary change as opposed to a reform. A revolutionary change requires a rethinking of even the function and role of the police, a rethinking of the function of the state, a rethinking of this as a structural problem rather than a problem of bad apples. That's a huge, like I said, a huge intellectual leap. It's a huge political leap. And it's a kind of leap that doesn't allow for easy answers. There's not a law that could fix this. No, you can't legislate this. You have to lead to a dramatic change in a lot of things, which includes de-escalating the police presence, demilitarizing the police. And by that, I don't just mean hardware, but just reducing the numbers of police officers whose role is to occupy certain communities. It means thinking about the relationship between the day-to-day violence produced by poverty, joblessness, homelessness, and just racism generally. And to change those things, reduce those things, and to create a life for people, not a subsistence, not just a pathway to prison, but an actual life. And so when organizers chant things like, Black Lives Matter, what they're really saying is that Black life matters.
Give us a sort of intellectual biography of this movement.
To me, the protests begin at the moment of emancipation, when former enslaved peoples are now saying, we're going to rebuild this nation in the period of Reconstruction. We're going to make this a new nation. We're going to make it based on democracy. And that impulse for democracy that's based on economic justice, social justice and a belief that life is something that everyone ought to have access to. That's not enshrined in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. It's enshrined in the actions of former slaves after the end of the Civil War. So when formal police forces were established in cities, the main function was to protect private property, to protect capital, to protect the wealthy, and to control the unruly poor. Whether they are Chinese laborers or whether they're African Americans, anyone perceived as a threat to private property, anyone organizing workers. I mean, think about the police. The police function was the same function as the early state militias and the National Guard. You chase fugitives, you put down strikes, this is what you do. The bottom line is that the impulse that comes out of Reconstruction for democracy is the impulse that we're seeing today. It's changed, it's evolved, it's been transformed, it's stretched, but that same impulse was always there. You cannot have democracy in a police state. They are not compatible. And we live in a police state.
That's a stretch, isn't it, for most communities and most of this country?
I think it's absolutely true. The difference is that most people benefit from the police state. You know, in other words, the police state's invisible. When I say police state, it's not a gulag state. It's not the old Soviet Union. What I mean is that the police role is overdetermined, and that includes those comfortable suburban communities that rely on the presence of police elsewhere to protect themselves and their property.
That was Robin Kelly at UCLA. He said to me, academics like him are playing catch-up every day, learning from activists who know much more than they do. Coming up, activists and scholars, starting with Professors Glenn Lowry and Peniel Joseph. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, taking the measure of this new cloud of protest from several angles.
Black women have always been at the forefront of movements. At the March on Washington, they did not allow a single woman leader to speak. Dr. Dorothy Height was more than capable of speaking. Ella Baker, more than capable of speaking about the work and to the work as organizers. Because of the work of our ancestors, we're able to be more visible, even though black women have always done the work.
That was Charlene Carruthers, head of the Black Youth Project 100. Glenn Lowry is professor of economics at Brown University, a man we respect over many years now, with strong ideas about race, justice, mass incarceration, just for starters. Welcome back, Glenn Lowry.
Thank you, Chris.
I read your bold argument in the Boston Review that Michael Brown, killed in Ferguson, Missouri, was not Rosa Parks. He wasn't Emmett Till either, you said. You get the first reply to Robin Kelly's line that police violence is the thread, almost always the trigger in this very, very old story.
Well, Robin Kelly had a lot to say, and I think a great deal of it was profound and certainly eloquent. And I get this idea, I get the narrative of situating the contemporary situation within the long history of violent repression of black people in this country. And I certainly, in listening to Kelly, would affirm many of the values that I think animates him in calling attention to the life-denying and repressive circumstances under which not only people of color, but many black people are living, and the role that excessive force used by police plays within that larger picture. But when I was bold enough to suggest to my editors at Boston Review that I'd entitle an essay, Michael Brown is No Rosa Parks, I had something rather specific in mind. I had in mind what actually transpired between Michael Brown, as best we can tell it, and Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri. That's on the table. A grand jury has deliberated. There's dispute. There's conflicting testimony. We don't have the time to go into that right now. But I had in mind the idea that taking a case of that sort, which was colored by the ambiguous circumstances and the behavior of Michael Brown and Darren Wilson in that situation. Brown did, it would appear, by most of the testimony, engage in an altercation with Officer Wilson. He did, it would appear, based upon the physical evidence as well as the eyewitness testimony, struggle with the officer over his gun. The officer ended up shooting Michael Brown to death. One can ask, I'm sure, whether or not that was necessary for the officer. Did he really feel in danger of his life and so forth? And therefore, perhaps he ought to have been brought to greater legal account for that. Let me just finish. But what I'm saying is that circumstance does not represent a clear, in my mind, enough instance of the, contemptuous, violent, and repressive, subjugation of African-American people. I don't want to take a case like that and build upon it a generalized set of claims about the character of the experience of African-American people in the United States. I don't think the case is representative. I think bundling a case like that with a very different case, what happened to Eric Garner on Staten Island, or a very different case yet, what happened to Tamir Rice in Cleveland, or cases from 50 or 75 or 100 years ago, is an exercise in constructing something that is perhaps serviceable for an ideological purpose, but that might not be at all descriptive of the actual realities.
What about his general argument, Glenn, that it's time to not only demilitarize the police, but to reduce their numbers in Black America?
So what I would say to that is there were over 2,000 murders a year in New York City some point a quarter century ago, roughly. There are 500 murders a year in New York City now, roughly, okay? That feels like improvement to me in the quality of life of people in New York City. I think that there are lives saved, and I think that some of those lives saved are Black, and I think that while there are many factors involved in the secular changes in the incidence of homicide in New York City, I give that as just one example, the activities of the police are among those factors. And so this idea that here in the 21st century, we're not talking about the early days of Reconstruction. We're not talking about the fight with ethnic immigrants for status and influence in American urban areas in the early 20th century. We're talking about the year 2014. The idea that the police and the repressive forces of the state constitute the major threat to the well-being of African-American people is absurd, in my view. I don't think it can be supported by the facts. And I'm not just talking about what the conservatives call black-on-black crime, okay? I mean, you could do a number of different exercises here. There are 2.25 million people under lock and key in this country. About half of them are Black. That means over 1 million Black people are in custody right now, in custody. They had to be taken into custody. The police are all over these communities, and that is something that can be objected to and argued about. But the idea that they constitute an occupying army, the idea that they represent a physical threat to the well-being of the community, even if you're not willing to credit that they actually provide services that promote public safety, the scope and scale of police, Black male interaction relative to a relative handful of cases that one can cite and make a big deal out of, I think is an exaggeration or of what's actually going on.
To change the subject abruptly, I wondered what you were thinking when Robin Kelly said, to me, an interesting point. He said, you can't treat this situation with a new law.
I thought that was a very interesting point, but I actually thought it pushed against the idea that what we're witnessing is something on a par with the civil rights movement in terms of its transformational potential. Now, I could be wrong about that, and nobody's got a crystal ball here. But the idea, the acknowledgement that what's being sought in protest is not the marginal adjustment of the legal landscape in response to this or that claim, but rather a transformation of consciousness, throws red flags up in front of my eyes with respect to whether or not that's actually something a, quote, movement, close quote, can accomplish.
I want to introduce Peniel Joseph, historian of the civil rights movement in America, a half century now in the past. He teaches at Tufts. You gave us an extraordinary conversation last winter, Peniel, about your biography of the offbeat Black Power visionary Stokely Carmichael. I'm wondering what the present protest, what sort of light it sheds on your own profound understanding of the civil rights movement. Looking back, how does it seem different? Do you see angles that weren't noticed in those days?
Well, no, I think, there's continuity and there's discontinuity. So I think one of the things that Robin was talking about was state violence. So I want to drill in on not just police violence, but this idea of state violence, whether we're talking about homelessness, whether we're talking about a lack of nutrition, whether we're talking about young Black children who live in environmentally toxic neighborhoods. The sociologist Monique Morris has a book that just came out called Black Stats, which gives us up-to-date figures, social economic figures, data on how African Americans are doing. 43.2 million African Americans, only 10% make $100,000 a year or more in the United States. 28% live below the poverty line. 40% of Black children in America today live below the poverty line, right? Mm. So when we're thinking about, like, how do we define institutional racism? How do we define racial disparities? And how would we define racial equality? The numbers are important. I know Glenn agrees with me here on that score. So the thing about state violence, though, state violence goes beyond Ferguson. The interesting thing for me, what Robin was talking about, and as a historian, I appreciate him giving us a long durée of Reconstruction to now. This idea of state violence certainly predates Reconstruction. It predates antebellum America. It goes, there's the new book, Empire of Cotton, out by Stanley Bevcourt.
We've been there.
That looks at, cotton in its global context. Ebony and Ivory by Craig Wilder, right? River of Dark Dreams. But then there's all this great stuff in terms of civil rights, mass incarceration. There's a new book called Captive Nation by Dan Berger that looks at organizing around prisons in the 1960s and 70s. So when we think about state violence, my whole understanding of state violence is inclusive of this idea of prisons and police, but it goes beyond that. And this is where Ferguson is very key, and so is Garner. Mm. What you saw in Ferguson, 22% of African Americans live below the poverty line. There's a great paper by Richard Rothstein about the roots of public policy and racial segregation in Ferguson. Now, that builds on all this great work by Kenneth Jackson and others on the FHA, the New Deal, FHA's Federal Housing Authority,
sure.
And in the way in which there was two-tiered liberalism. Ira Katz Nelson's book, Fear Itself, but also
When
Affirmative Action Was White, really shows us in a systematic way how state violence was enacted against African Americans. So we can see a through line away from just Michael Brown and Emmett Till to the way in which these disparities in terms of wealth, in terms of racial segregation residentially, in terms of building zones, the way in which how come African Americans live in neighborhoods where you can build businesses and other things, and whites live in exclusively residential neighborhoods. So this idea of state violence is very telling. And in Ferguson, 22% live below the poverty line, right? Massive unemployment and teenage unemployment. New York Times did a front page story on the number of warrants given out to young Black men in Ferguson, right?
So this is average of three per house or something.
This is much more, this is beyond just Michael Brown and Darren Wilson. So what the young people in Ferguson, but also Garner and all around the country are seeing is that they are trapped in systematic marginalization, systematic racial and economic oppression. And what they're doing, one thing that you didn't say, Black Lives Matter is the key. We've gone from civil rights, Black Power to Black Lives Matter. That is a universal call, but Black equality is at the core of it, because that's the common denominator. If Black folks gain equality in this country, it's going to reverberate to all these different disparate groups.
Time out in the Faculty Club. We got Street Wisdom on the line in St. Louis, from St. Louis. We know Buki Barigeshian as an activist to watch and to listen to. She teaches art history at St. Louis University, and she coordinates the Organization for Black Struggle in Missouri. Buki, welcome to Open Source.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This movement today is coalescing, as the civil rights movement did not, around women, and I'm wondering why. Women speaking of their own pain. And in leadership roles here.
Yeah, and I'll actually say, the civil rights movement didn't coalesce around women in a visible way. That's an addendum that I'll, you know, a little amendment that I'll make to your statement is that they weren't visibly there.
Of course.
Right? So there were women who were really at the heart and soul
right.
of the functioning of the civil rights movement. They were, you know, organizing. They were making phone calls to turn people out to church meetings. You know, they were cooking for organizers and, you know, men who were meeting. And they were all, you know, they were involved in a real way. And now you're starting to see them being involved in a much more visible way. No less important to the movement than they've been in the past, but again, much more taking a front stance. So,
and where would they take the movement differently this time?
I mean, I think there's a lot of issues that should be addressed and are being addressed by women this time around that were not being addressed in the past. We talk about patriarchy, right? This is an ongoing issue that I think really was subsumed in the civil rights movement in the 60s and even before that. The patriarchy of the actual liberation movement, which is a contradiction in and of itself. We talk about sexuality, right? Sexuality is something that I think has always been an oppression in and of itself, not just for women, but also, you know, for all genders and for all sexualities. And so when we talk about sort of a homonormative, right, we talk about the way that that is wrapped up in this liberation struggle, not just for how it impacts race, but how it impacts those who are, you know, Black, but, you know, may claim alternate sexualities or non-normative sexualities. And so it's really important to understand that that is all part of what is being driven, what is driving people now in this struggle.
Buki, I'm not sure people can hear it in your voice, but we know you were born in Nigeria, a Nigerian girl to age 9. And I'm wondering, what is the complexity of angles in your own head? What is the transnational flavor of this movement coming out of Ferguson?
Well, I mean, you said a Nigerian girl until age 9, but actually I would still claim to be Nigerian. You know, I have an American passport now, but I still feel very strongly about my heritage. And trust and believe, my parents make sure I feel it too. But, I mean, you know, growing up, and I think we talked about this a little bit, growing up, I was very much sort of in the middle of things, not necessarily feeling as if I was part of one group or the other. You know, I wasn't completely Black because, you know, my friends who were Black, who were Black Americans, they could hear in my voice and they could see in my, you know, behavior that I didn't quite fit, right? And of course, for friends who were white, they could immediately see that I wasn't quite one of them. So it was sort of like this middle ground, this limbo that allowed me to kind of be able to observe certain things. And I think even thinking about it beyond that in a transnational way, we tend to think of Black Americans and, you know, African diaspora as being completely separate. And I think that is a huge flaw when we think about Black liberation on a global scale, right? We need to think about struggle in terms of the way that it implicates racism and actually uses power structures, global power structures, to tear apart potential alliances across African diasporas. My father himself, when he came here, you know, as a professor teaching here, he was really strongly involved still in the politics back home and pro-democracy movement in Nigeria, which had for decades been ruled by, you know, dictators, right?
Right, and it was a nasty battle even in your childhood. I mean, we remember a tyrannical trampling of individual rights. How does that frame your vision today?
I mean, you see state power, state-sponsored violence being used at that particular time, particularly in the 1990s in Nigeria. You see state-sponsored violence being used to crush opposition, being used to crush resistance, being used to crush conscientious objection to the way that the state was actually, the relationship that the state was creating with its people, which was a very repressive one, a very oppressive one. And here, now, in Ferguson, living in St. Louis, I see very similar things, the way that the state is equipping police with military weapons to suppress uprising, to suppress conscientious conversations and conscientious protests by citizens, right? Citizens who, according to the Bill of Rights, have every right to be doing what they're doing, yet they are being they're being attacked for doing what they're doing, right, in a military scale.
Peniel Joseph, I want to ask you and Glenn Lowry, what's our question to activism in St. Louis this evening for Buki?
Yeah, no, my question would be, when you think about, I've seen online the Ferguson action demands, and there's a list of six demands talking about ending mass incarceration, talking about unemployment, talking about all these great things that I think are very, very important and policy specific. How do you see on the ground with the movement you're doing on the ground connecting to real policy goals? Because in my mind, when we think about social movements, they're creatively disruptive, they're morally impassioned, but they're also policy specific.
I think the way that I see it happening is by actually breaking down what we usually consider to be policy goals, which is things that, you know, are generated in office spaces and capitals, right, in legislative spaces, and really making them things that are generated by the people who have been protesting and who are most impacted. So one thing that we're trying to do is really engage with people who have been on the streets and some people who even have not been on the streets, asking them to come into, you know, public assemblies, come into people's assemblies and share your ideas, share your concerns, the things that you see that are most troubling to you about your community or the way that your community is being shaped, right? And by actually having these conversations in these public spaces, in these people's assemblies, we can start to identify the things that we really want to transform about our reality.
Bukhi Badagation in St. Louis, I thank you for joining us, and we wish you the very best. Coming up, protest as an artistic statement, as a sort of political event that many people experience first in music, in preaching, or dance, as a pulse of the zeitgeist. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Cultural historian Jeff Chang wrote the book on the birth of hip-hop in the ruins of the South Bronx 40 years ago. His title was Can't Stop, Won't Stop. We asked him what he's hearing in the song and the rap narratives coming out of Ferguson since the summer.
You know, a lot of the most amazing hip-hop now doesn't come out of the cities, which have been completely gentrified. They come instead from places that poor folks of color have been pushed towards, so they're the aging segregated suburbs.
Let the rhythm hit 'em.
If we take it back to the 1960s, right, after the civil rights movement wins its major legislative victories, what you see is conservatives trying to figure out how to reshape and realign the party system, right? And so the Southern Strategy is born. The wealth gap, the income gap, the housing gap, the debt gap, the student debt gap, all of these kinds of gaps are getting bigger and bigger every year. And we see actual rates of resegregation approaching the levels of Brown v. Board of Education. And so I look to young people who are working in the culture to try to figure out ways that we can dream together. And people who have a deep understanding, I think, of what Martin Luther King was talking about. In the 1960s, he was saying, end segregation, end the war, and end poverty. And I see these young people going right back to that message. I'm just hopeful that this particular moment brings us to a place where we're able to see the connections and try to figure out what our shared future could look like, what our common goals and our common values are as we move forward.
Jeff Chang is queuing our guest on the phone. Tef Poe is being designated as the Bob Dylan of St. Louis. He's 26 years old, a sometime gangster rapper, a work in progress, who's had the role of Ferguson's bard and narrator thrust upon him. Tef Poe, welcome to Open Source. Delighted to meet you.
Hey, how's it going?
So far, so good. But you're the home run hitter here. You've evolved yourself out of a bad old chauvinist voice toward a new place. I want to know your story, the story of you in 2014.
I mean, I think you guys only caught a portion of the narrative that I bring to the table. Always had same things in my music about anti-homophobic lyrics, anti-misogyny, but I also come from an environment where those things are real as well. So I've always, I'm a young man that's growing up in a society that's forever morphing and just finding my way through the music. I think nowadays too many artists are dishonest about their actual lifestyle in the music. Everyone wants to appear to be completely righteous or completely savage, so to speak. And I try to walk between both of those worlds because I think that's what the human experience is.
What's your version of the protest and especially going forward?
I mean, my version of the protest has just been a bunch of young people resisting a very brutal order of the police, very brutal kind of occupation of our neighborhood, and just trying to respond to this situation with a little bit more compassion than, you know, the older people, a little bit more compassion than the politicians and the lawmakers. I think that we view this as an emotional thing more so than a matter of legal principality.
You know, I have to say there's a healthy suspicion in your world of the people you're talking to right now, an old white radio dude and two professors. I wish you'd teach us, teach Robin Kelly, even Ta-Nehisi Coates, even Barack Obama, what we've all got to master in this teachable moment.
It's really just stand with the community, stand with the people. People are fed up and tired of being ignored just because of components in their life that they can't control. And I think that what's different about Ferguson than a lot of situations in the past, people ask what made this so different. We threw out our fundamental differences on the front line. So I could stand next to a gay white guy that was getting tear gassed. I could stand next to a young lady that's dropped out of college, doesn't come from the same neighborhood that I come from whatsoever, but we're both under attack at that very moment. And we're both physically putting our bodies on the line to send a message to the police. I think it's all about making yourself uncomfortable and not being afraid to make the people around you uncomfortable as well. I think it's all about finally admitting that America has a race problem. Instead of portraying ourselves as if black people have been liberated in America, because we haven't, I think it's all about not being afraid of the consequences. The only thing that the police can do to you is kill you or lock you up. Once you are beyond those points of fear, they don't have much power. They're not God. So for us, this is about, you know, they're not being a gray area. If poverty is wrong, let's treat it like it's wrong. If racism is wrong, let's treat it like it's wrong. If racial profiling is wrong, let's respond accordingly. And I think that's what you're seeing happening with poor and disenfranchised people all across America and now the world.
Glenn Lowry, I'd love your take and your response to Tef Poe.
Well, I don't know that I have a response. You said to him, teach us, and I think I've been listening and learning. And I think one of the things I'm learning is that nobody knows once you arouse these energies and once you get this kind of mobilization and dynamism going, where it's going to go and what it's ultimately going to speak to. So notwithstanding the fact that, you know, and I've already said it here on this program, I had my doubts about the canonization of Michael Brown as an iconic figure representing something large within the context of the American social scene. Notwithstanding that, the fact that people like this young man we're listening to and others are doing what they're doing with their art and through their political participation and in their self-expression and in their organization and coalescing, this is interesting. I just want to add one thing quickly. And call me an old fuddy-duddy, but I'm not entirely comfortable with having this conversation and this movement, I put that in inverted commas, framed in racial terms, framed in terms of long narrative of the sufferings of African-American people and the contemporary marginalization of people of color. Both of those things are true, the long narrative and the contemporary marginalization. But when I think about how one gets from here to there, there's both a kind of, you know, pragmatic judgment, and then there's also a principled concern. The pragmatic judgment is we need allies, like the young white people, the college students, the low-income people who may be mobilized. We need allies. If you're going to get the war on drugs reversed, if you're going to go back on the sentencing laws that are at the root of mass incarceration and so forth, the movement needs to be broader. But the cautionary concern has to do with the fact that this racialization is a double-edged sword. If we count every black unarmed person killed by a white police officer with an asterisk next to it, and we aggregate that up into some case of a phenomenon said to be going on in American society, we're inviting somebody to count white people who might be the victims of criminal acts by blacks. In the same spirit, the spirit that is of course, it would be completely unacceptable. Of course, we would have our cautionary, defenses up. But the next time I have a white police officer killed by a black criminal, I'm putting that in inverted commas. And I start seeing people organizing in the street about that, I'll know that we've stepped onto a slippery slope.
May I say in this teachable moment, Tepo, what I hear you saying, among other things, is that we have a deep fear of human freedom, starting with ourselves, one by one, not to mention collectively.
Yeah, I do feel that way, and I feel even more so. In 2014, I believe young black people are moving towards a point where we're not going to demonize or vilify ourselves for being black. We're not going to vilify ourselves for being different. We're not going to run away from the narrative of saying, you know what? You know just as well as I know that if your daughter brought me home for dinner, then it would be a problem. Why would it be a problem? Simply because I'm being judged about according to the color of my skin before you even recognize the merit of my personality or the range of my intellect.
Peniel Joseph, I want to know what you're learning here.
Yeah, one of the big things is this, and I agree with some of what Glenn was saying, but the struggle for black equality is the struggle for racial and economic justice and American democracy, transforming American democracy. So one of the things that the new millennials are understanding is that you can say Black Lives Matter, and that's universal. That's the whole thing. That's the whole point of this. And I think that's what's so extraordinary about all this movement in the streets, because if we can end the institutional racism against black people, so many people are also caught up in the reverberating nets of that, including poor whites, including LGBT. That's the whole thing. How does economic justice and real equality look like in the United States? If you end this what's happened to black people historically in this country, and remember, the racial and economic exploitation continues. It's not just state violence. There are certain things we can end right now. Brennan Center for Law, in terms of at the federal level, this year was the first time since 1980 that we had less federal people in prison by about 2,500, right? And we're projecting by 2016, there'll be 10,000 less prisoners. President Obama can do things right now through executive order that does things like federal grants. Federal grants right now are all about states incarcerating more brown and black men and women. We can lessen recidivism. We can move towards rehabilitation, because policy at the end of the day is going to be a part of the solution.
Policy is one thing. The artist version is another. Tepo, I'm so grateful to you for sharing yours. We take it very seriously. We'll be parsing your words for the rest of the week. Thank you, and
thank
all
you
the best.
Much. Thank you.
Here's one more voice from a quarter that carried a lot of the leadership burden in the civil rights movement, the Black Christian Church. Jonathan Walton grew up in a church-going family in Atlanta. He went to Morehouse College and then Princeton Theological Seminary. He is now the minister of the Memorial Church at Harvard, where he has thrown the weight of his exalted position into encouraging the die-in in Harvard Yard the other day and the ongoing campus version of the protest. I asked him about the preacher's part in a movement underway.
I think it's always been young people who are at the forefront of movements of positive change. I mean, if we think about the civil rights movement, we think about young people. It was a Claudette Colvin and Mary Louise Smith who sat down on a bus in Montgomery before Rosa Parks. It was students from North Carolina A&T that were sitting down at the lunch counters at Woolworth in Greensboro, North Carolina, before many of the preachers came along. Because quite often, the church, unfortunately, and to use the words of Dr. King, has served as a thermometer of the larger society rather than a thermostat of the larger society. And I would hope that all of my brothers and sisters, not only in the Christian faith, but of all faith perspectives, would get out and join forces with our young people, because it's consistent with the varying religious tenets we preach as it relates to peace, justice, and a world where everybody is viewed as equal.
Glenari, can we stand the idea that children will lead us?
Well, as a man in his seventh decade of life, I don't think I've got any alternative but to be led by the kids. And as somebody who's been listening to this debate in the United States about race and inequality for, you know, longer than I care to remember, for a half century, inspiring to think that there could be something fresh and new to say about it, because the conversations on race that I've seen orchestrated in the last quarter century have not really moved me, and they haven't moved the country. I certainly do hope that we're not looking at something like the energy around the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations.
Me too. That's the ghost that haunts this moment.
This has been different from that, and I tell you why. Because right after Ferguson was announced, 3 days before Thanksgiving, the next day, 170 cities erupted. Right after Eric Garner, massive protest, including the shutting down of major highways, something that was not a tactic during the heroic period of the civil rights movement or even black power and feminism and other social movements. So what we've seen, the most organized dissent in the United States empirically since 1970 over the last few weeks, and especially between August and December of this year, and without the violence that accompanied that dissent, not only in 1970, but like Robin was saying, when you start in 1963 in Birmingham, you go up to 1968, 69, there's over 350 recorded civil disturbances in over 250 American cities. We only remember Newark, Detroit, Watts, Harlem in 1964, York, Pennsylvania, Plainfield, New Jersey, Louisville, Kentucky. I mean, these things happened. So when we think about what's going on right now, this is the biggest organized dissent. This is an insurgency. This is a social movement. How long it will last, we'll see, right? But this is not Occupy Wall Street. This is actually something much bigger. Just empirically, that's what's so profound that we're seeing. We're witnessing history. We're living in extraordinary times. People are demanding a new deal, a greater great society, and everybody's jaws are dropping because they haven't witnessed this in their lifetimes. Barack Obama was born August 4th, 1961. He was 9 when Kent State happened, 8 when Kent State happened, right? He was 7 when Dr. King was assassinated. He was 4, not yet 4, when Malcolm X was assassinated. So all he could do was talk and think about the movement. He went to Occidental College in 1979. What we're seeing right now is history unfolding before our eyes.
And I hope you're right. I just got to say, though, I watched the state police on the Common this past weekend in Boston, and they're all out in their spiffy new day glow hoodies. They've got these, they're going to camp with their uniform black, you know, athletic bags and stuff. They're better dressed than the protesters. I think they're better prepared than the protesters. They've got their choppers overhead too. I mean, I'm wondering, you know,
they're not the enemy. I mean, I have to
I don't want to make them the enemy, but I have a feeling that they understand the plan better than the kids do.
Yeah.
Answer me.
Yeah, it's an organized bureaucracy. You know, there's no surprise that in relative to a decentralized and inchoate movement that they would be, in some sense, quote, better prepared, close quote.
So
I want to say this, though, about the civil disturbances of the 1960s. People have studied the aftermath in the cities in which those disturbances occurred. And my sense of it is that some of these communities never recovered from the economic hit that they took from the disturbances. I'm with a historian here, an erudite historian. I don't want to get into a debate about what caused what, but one wonders whether at the end of the day, the, quote, uprisings that people talk about in Newark, New Jersey, and Detroit, and also in York, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, were worth the candle in terms of the subsequent impact on the lives of those people.
That's another radio show.
I'll say is Dr. King said that rioting was the language of the unheard. So certainly I think what you saw there was desperation meeting injustice. And we're seeing much more constructive protest right now because people aren't being violent. People are saying they want a voice and they want fundamental systematic transformation of this entire system.
Peniel Joseph, we're going to do this again with Glenn Lowry. Maybe Tef Poe, too. I hope so. Thanks also to Buki Bagadeshan, to Robin Kelly, and to Jonathan Walton. Our show is produced by a lot of good people that I don't have time to name. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please join us next time on Open Source.